on in Megillah, Daf Gimel Amud Beis. All right. So on Chol HaMoed, then we learn that the women who are part of the funeral, he says, they're ma'anos, as they do recite dirges, aval lo metapkos, but they do not beat their breasts or do not clap their hands in mourning, whatever it may be. Okay. Rabbi Shmuel comes and he says, im hayutz muchos lamita, if they are, however, close to the actual stretcher, you know, that they were used in order to carry the dead body on. Mita means over here, not exactly a bed, but, you know, they put them like on the stretcher to bring, you know, to the Beis Halem, you know, okay? Then, in that particular case, so, metapres, then they are permitted to do that too. In other words, it would depend upon their proximity to where the dead body is. If they were very close by, then in that case they were permitted to be metapres. If they were further away, then in that case they did not. Okay. The Rosh and Chodoshim, Amish Chodesh, the Chanukah of Purim, and on Chanukah of Purim, me'anos u'metapchos b'zeh v'zeh. They do both of them. They are permitted to do. In other words, there are certain things in mourning that are permitted to do on these days. Aval lo mekononos, but they do not recite a kinah. Now, the question is, a lamentation. How does that differ? So one interpretation of a kinah is that one woman would say a verse or something like that, and then all the women would repeat the same thing. And then she would say something else. And then it reminds me we used to have tchinas that the women used to use, you know, in Yiddish. Yeah. And, the women did not have the education to know how to read the machzor or something like that, so you had what they called zogarits. Zogarit, whatever you want to say. But, a woman who knew, how to say it, and then the other women running around, they would repeat the same thing that they heard. Okay. I guess if you said Oyes is Hasten Shul, so they will also Oyes is Hasten Shul. All right. Now, what do we learn from this? From this statement, right, we learn what? That why do we say, that Purim is so important that we have the Mikra Megillah, right, and that should put aside what? That they should put aside a funeral or something like that. You understand? This is the reason why they quote it over here. Right. So, the Omer Rabbi Bahuna, said, Ein Moed Bifdei Tabit Chachmin, continues, and he says, these laws that, say that you cut down on the amount of mourning during Yontif, this does not apply to a person who is a Talmud Chacham. For him, you have to put in a full panoply of mourning, okay? Kol Shekein, so if this is true of Chol HaMoed, then it's certainly true for Chanukah and Purim, right? So they say, no, that's not exactly so. Why? Because they say, Kavo Torah Ka'amid, right? We're talking about now the covet that you give to the Torah itself. Kavo Torah de Yochud Chomor, right? But Talmud Torah de Yochid Kal, which means what? A person who has spent his life in studying Torah, right, and he's a Talmud Torah, so the kavod that you have to give to a person who has that, you're doing it really for the sake to show honor to Torah, not so much to the individual. So there, in that case, then you carry out what? All the full the full fashion of mourning, the na'anos, metapchos, the konanos, and so on and so forth, okay? But if it is only an individual who is studying Torah at that moment, then in that particular case, what? Then he could put aside his Torah studies for a few moments and do what? And go and listen to the reading of the Megillah. Okay. So, now that we have established, that the reading of the Megillah should put aside, that is the importance of the reading, should put aside some of the other things, put aside some of your other activities in order to come and listen to the reading Megillah. So Omar Rava said, Pshita li. So from this, it's clear to me, he says, Avodo Nikro Megillah, that when it comes to a question of the sacrificial service on the Beis HaMikdash and the reading of the Megillah, so Mikro Megillah Odif takes precedence, okay? The reading of the Megillah takes precedence. Midah Rav Yossi Bar Chanina, as we learned before, you know, this is the opinion of Rav Yossi Bar Chanina. Talmud Torah and Mikro Megillah, and when, how about the study of Torah and reading of the Megillah? So Mikro Megillah Odif. Again, we see that the reading of the Megillah takes precedence, but it's Sumpush Beis Rabbi. As we learned, you know, that the household of Rabbi, Rabbi Yehuda Anossi, you know, relied upon this idea. Talmud Torah, Meis Mitzvah. Now we come to a new question. How about Talmud Torah and Meis Mitzvah? Studying Torah, and all of a sudden, what do? You encounter a dead body, and there's nobody there to take care of the body. So, which gets priority? The answer is Meis Mitzvah, right? The Meis Mitzvah gets priority. How do we know that? Midatanya, because we have a Baraisa which tells us that you put aside, you postpone the study of Torah in order to carry on the Levaya of a dead person. And also you do that for what? Ulachmosos Kala. And also to escort a bride, you know, to the chuppah. Okay? For a wedding, right. Yes.
Here, because sometimes if people have to go to work,
right,
and there's a Megillah reading, should we go to the Megillah reading or should we deal with the Mesa?
Yeah, you're right. No question. In that particular case, you have to see, I mean, how can you fit in the schedule,
we,
you see,
we
right?
Find somebody that can do it at all.
Right, exactly.
But
yeah.
If you can,
then this actually, then the Meis Mitzvah takes precedence
right.
In that case.
Gemara here says Meis Mitzvah at first,
yeah.
And the second time it says Lehalti Meis. They're two different things, really. Meis is anybody who's there. Meis Mitzvah, there's nobody else around.
Okay, you're right. But actually, they're using it in order to teach us, you know, the business of the Meis Mitzvah. Okay. But you're right, I mean, that the Hotzos HaMeis applies to any funeral in general in which you are involved, you know, that you should take the time out in order to go to the funeral, in order to show covid, you know, to the person
right,
who's passed
but
away.
Don't you,
yeah.
If there's no chevra in the town,
yeah.
Everybody has to come to the meis. This is why you have chevras in the town.
Right.
So that the people, normal people can go about their work, and the people, the chevra, it's their job to do it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. No question about that. Yeah, that would be the implication. Yeah. Okay. All right. So now, we said that Avodah Meis Mitzvah. Yeah, what about if, for example, there was Avodah, there was time, let's say, for the Kohen to sacrifice in the Beis HaMikdash, right? And all of a sudden somebody dropped dead and there was nobody to take care of over there. So Meis Mitzvah, in that case, you have to do it. And how do we know that? We know that by interpretation of one word, and that is with the achoisa into his sister. The Tanya, as we have, as we've learned in the Baraisa, is la achoisa ba. What do we have to do? How do we interpret the word la achoisa? Now, first of all, let me give you the background. La achoisa here, we're not talking about the aroyas that we find in Sefer Vayikra, you know, like in Parsha Achrei Mois, or in Kedoshim, okay? But we're talking now about the Nozir, which we'll be reading in Yirtzeh Hashem when we read Parsha Nozir, okay? Another couple of weeks. So, Parsha Nozir, you know, one of the chapters deals with a person who is a Nazirite, okay? Takes a vow upon himself that for 30 days or for even an extended period, he's going, you know, to refrain from wine, right? Not eat any grapes, going to let his hair grow, and so on. But another prohibition that the Torah puts upon the person who takes the vow of being a Nozir is that he's not allowed to be mitame for any close relatives. And it mentions Ilda Ovi, Ilda Yimai, right? Elohi, Ilda Achoisei. So the question is, why did they have to have Lachoise? Obviously, and obviously, so all the more reason, you know, Lachoise, and so also that he should not be Mitabi, right? So what is it there for? So if we don't need it for one thing, then we use it for another situation. Okay, so what is the other situation? Lachoise, Matamun Leimar. What is the Torah teaching us by including this? So he says, well, the following example. Let's say a person is on his way in order to shecht his Korban Pesach. Or, the Lomol Esbono, he was on his way to circumcise his son. The Shoma, and he heard, Shemes Lomes, that he had lost a close relative, right? The father, mother, and so on, okay? So, Yochel Yatame, should he then be matami, in other words, immediately, you know, observe the mourning and so on, and not do what? Not shech the Korban Pesach, or not to go ahead with the bris of his son, right? So Amrit, so in such a case we say, lo yatami. He should not defile himself. In other words, he has to carry out, first of all, the shechitas of Korban Pesach, or the circumcision. Why? So if you remember,
conditioned by time.
Yeah, not only is they conditioned by time, you're absolutely right. I mean, Korban Pesach is the only time you can do it, right? We're not talking about the fact, you know, he was already in a previous state of tumor, so they couldn't come and do it, because with that we have a Pesach Sheni, okay? But here, he was actually on his way into the Beis HaMikdash in order to do it, and suddenly he got a report, you know. So, what should he do? Forgo the, you know, the observance of Pesach? On the contrary, both the Korban Pesach and the Mitzvah of Milah, these are the only two affirmative mitzvahs that we find in the Torah, which, if you don't observe them, they are punishable by Kores. Okay? Because in both cases, as you know, v'nichas ha'nefshei. Okay? Any other affirmative commandment that is mentioned, if you don't do it, you're not going to get Kores if you disobey it. Okay?
But, yeah. You know, I know, but Korban Pesach, Pesach Sheni. When does it end?
Yeah, but I said we're not talking about where a person is already coming beforehand.
Okay.
That's what I said. Or, he was the other example that they give in the Torah, namely, he was a Derech Rechoika, he was far away, so he couldn't get to the Beis HaMikdash in time or something for the Shechitas Korban Pesach.
Once he's there, he's there. Yeah.
Right, right. So he should go ahead with that. Okay. Yeah. So, Yoch, yeah, Kishem Shem. Okay. Well, I look up. I have to find my place again. Okay. All right. Daniel says, "Tamata, Harisho, Yohelech, the Shchid is there." All right. Show me some Mislo Meis. Yoch, Yitami, right? So, should he then be Mitami? So, Amrit, Lo Yitami. We say no, right? So, we continue the argument. Yoch. All right, maybe Kishem Sheinu Mitami LaChoisei, just as he does not, he's not allowed to be Mitami for his sister, Kachinu Mitami LaMeis Mitzvah, so likewise should we say that he is not to Mitami himself for Meis Mitzvah, if what? If he was on his way to Shecht his Korban Pesach, right? Or to circumcise his son? Talmud Leima, this is why the Talmud, this is why the Torah comes and says LaChoisei. No. His sister, Lachoise Hudeinu Mitame, right? That, yes, he's not allowed to be Mitame, but Mitame Lemeis Mitzvah. But he must defile himself, right, in order to help to bury a Mes Mitzvah. Okay. So, boy, Rava, so Rava asked the following question. Says, Mikro Megillah Lemeis Mitzvah. All right. Reading of the Megillah and the Meis Mitzvah, Haiminayu Odev, which is the one that should take the priority, right? Which is the more important? So he says, Mikra Megillah Odev, right? Right? The reading of the Megillah should be more important, Mishum Pirsumi Nisa, right? Because what are we doing when we read the Megillah? We are proclaiming the importance of the Nes. Oh, Dilmore, maybe that's not so. maybe mes mitzvah odif, right? That the mes mitzvah is more important. Why? Mishum kvod habrios, because we have to show respect for human beings, other human beings. So after he raised this question, he then gave his own answer. Now, what is the answer? You know, sometimes he asks rhetorical questions. Or you ask a question and suddenly it hits you. I know the answer. Okay. So this is Hodapashti. So he then gave his explanation. He realized, he says, what? Meis mitzvah odif. That takes priority. To take care of the dead person, that takes priority even over the reading of the Megillah. The Omar, even as an authority said, one of the Rabbanon said, Godol Kibbut HaBriyos, great is the honor that we have to show for our fellow human beings, She Doicha Es Leisaaseh, because it pushes aside a negative commandment in the Torah. Okay? Which tells us, I mean, we have to do this, we have to do that, or something like that, but nevertheless, or we shouldn't do this, when it comes to showing honor for a dead person and so on, here this takes the priority. So it's good for us to remember that Kovod HaBriyos is very, very important, that we have to show respect and honor to all our human beings. Okay, we'll call it a night at this particular point. All right, first let's identify tonight is the 30th of May in the year 2001. We are continuing now the study of Megillah, Daf Gimel, Amud Beis, continuing roughly more than a halfway point on the page. Okay. Gufa. Gufa means, all right, now let's get back to a discussion of what we started with before we got sidetracked with other things, okay? Before we started goofing around, okay? Why not? So, Omer Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi. Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi said, Krach v'chol asoma chlo v'chol anira emo kidon kikrach. All right, this goes back again to a question that we had started some time ago. We said, we define the word krach as a city which is walled, right? And we also learned that even though there is one authority who says walled from the days of Achashverosh, nevertheless, but the Mishnah itself, and that's the halacha, is that it has to be walled from the times of Yehoshua ben Nun, right? Bimos Yehoshua ben Nun. So now the question is, how about areas which are adjacent to the krach? Do they follow the rule of the krach, namely that the Megillah is read on the 15th of Adar, or do they follow the rule of unwalled cities and towns and villages, etc., etc., in other words, the average place that people are living in, where we read the Megillah on the 14th. Okay? This is what the question is. So they're getting back to that. So Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi says that as far as a krach, as far as a walled city is concerned, it's also v'chol ha-samuch lo. Every spot which is right near it, that's number one, v'chol ha-nireimo, and where the city can be seen from this place. All right, so we're actually giving two definitions. One is physical propinquity, nearness in English. Okay. Right. And the other is do you have to be able to see the big city or not? So he says, right, that it requires both elements. It has to be physically near, and also it has to be, you know, can it also, you have to be able to see the big city from where it is. So they immediately question this. They say, Heichem Mishkachasla, tell me, how does this occur? So Omar Rabbi Yirmiyahu explained, and he said, it occurs as, for example, whoa. I skipped a Veyazmir. Okay, right. All right, Nidon Kikrach, right. So, Tana, we have learned in Ibaraisa, it so happens, that there is a definition for what is the meaning of the word samuch, that it is near. And what is near means near, afal pi she'eino nira, even though you cannot see the big city from where you are, as close as you are physically to it, okay? Nira, right? So that is afal pi she'eino samuch. Then we have the other one, namely, if you can see the big city, even though it's not so close to it, okay? But of course, the implication that in both cases, what would they do? They would follow the lead of the krach, of the walled city, and read at the same time, okay? So now they break this down. They say, Bishlamo, okay, we can understand this, what? Nira afal pishen esomach, nashkacheslo. Yeah, there are times when, for example, you can see a city even though you're not that close to it physically. Kigon, as for example, the Yosva Barosh Ahar. Let us say that the city is located on top of a hill, top of a mountain, right? Okay? So it is possible, even though you're not so close to it physically, but nevertheless you can see it in the distance and it's not that far. You can see it. So that's one possibility, it says. Right. Okay, but he says, Ella Samoch, how could you have a place which is close by, afal pi she'eino nira, right? Even though the city itself cannot be seen, even though you're very close by to it, heichi mashkacheslo, where does it happen? How can you find such a situation? So, Rabbi Yirmiyahu, this is where Rabbi Yirmiyahu said, sheyoshevus banachal. Let's say the big city is down in the valley, and, you know, maybe there's a little hill or something like that that interferes with the view of where the place close by is located. So it is close by, but the fact is, what, that you still can't see the big city. So nevertheless, the question is, does the closeness therefore govern the fact that it is,
Actually, I get the impression here that you have to see the open town from the big city in order for the open town to observe the same way as the walled city. It's not the other way around.
Well, but the emphasis seems to be upon the fact that it's the walled city that is primary in this case. Right. And
they're the focal point.
Correct. So, is it near to it, or can it be seen from it, and so on? And this is what he's saying.
The walled city, right.
Or the other way around.
Yeah.
Or the other way around.
You're
yeah.
talking from two points of view.
Yeah.
Two
right.
View.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you're talking that you got to be in the outside place and be able to see the walled city, is what you're saying, Rabbi.
Yeah.
You just put it the other way around.
Yeah.
Yeah. But if we say that the original statement means that it has to have both characteristics, then of course it would rule out
anything.
One or the other.
Yeah.
Okay.
So seeing the walled city would mean being the territory outside the gates, literally.
Oh, yeah, naturally. We're talking
you
about that.
You just have to see the
right.
wall is all you can
okay.
see.
Let's say that Springfield
right?
were located on top of a hill, okay? And Long Meadow can see the city of Springfield, which is a walled city, okay? So the question is, how do we define it? Is it near? Can it be seen? Maybe you can't see it, but it's close by physically or something like that. So therefore it should fall into the influence
so
of
it. So it's either or.
Right. It should be either or in this particular case. Right. But to me it makes more sense to take it not so much in the, you know, but no, this is what it says, you know, somach afal pi she'eino nira, and nira afal pi she'eino somach. In other words, either it's close or it can be seen. So
right.
in either case, it would follow the, you know, the krach, the walled city. Okay. All right.
There are probably some towns around the walled cities that had to.
But after all, you have suburbs, right? You have places that are built up, you know, nearby and so on.
You said something about it,
yeah, correct, right. There was a hill that separated the view, but you're very close by.
Yeah.
Right. later on, they're going to ask the question, you know, is there a distance, for example, as to what near means?
Yeah, right.
And a conclusion, the statement that is made, which is accepted as the official statement, is if it is within a mile. Now, of course, again, as I explained the other day, it's not an American mile, but is the Roman mile of their day, which was maybe about 3,000 something or other feet away or something like that, okay? Wasn't as big because, as I explained, I mean, the word mile in Latin, you know, is really 1,000, mille, okay? And it's short for mille passus, which means 1,000 paces, which means that, you know, the average Roman soldier, if he paced 1,000 paces, so that was a mile, okay? And so that's how they measured distance, right? The Persians had a different way of doing it. And the Persians, for example, they went in terms of parsa, okay? And parsa in Greek comes out as the word parasang. Yeah, if you read parasang, P-A-R-A-S-A-N-G. Parasang, right. It's a measure of distance, and that was longer in distance than the mile. It was longer. Okay, so that's the way the Persians counted, okay? So we find both sorts of measurements mentioned in the Talmud, either mil or we find parsa, okay? Yes?
It just occurred to me that the Roman mil is very close to the present day kilometer, which would make sense, 1,000 meters, assuming that the Roman soldier could pace off approximately 3 feet or 39 inches.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, that's quite possible. Of course, I mean, the metric system was not developed until the time of the French Revolution, Napoleon, and, you know, this is when it became an official form of measurement.
Isn't a kilometer like
2.2 miles?
No.
2.2?
Yeah, that's a kilogram, right. It's 2.2 pounds. It's equal to 1 kilogram. Okay, yeah. All right. Okay. All right. So this is one definition then that we have that, that a place which is very close by to the krach then meets at the same time that the krach was. I told you that when my daughter and son-in-law moved in to Ramot Polin, there were authorities who said that this was too far away from Jerusalem, even though it's part of Jerusalem. They said that you can't see the Har HaBayis, you cannot see the Temple Mount from there. So therefore they said we should be reading on the 14th and not on the 15th. But by now they've made peace and decided to observe the 15th. Okay. Whoever the authority is, I guess he changed his mind eventually, and because there are others, you know, who disagreed with his point of view. Okay. So now all of Yerushalayim reads the same time. They all observe the 15th. Okay. All right. Now to continue. The Yomer Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi. And another statement now attributed to Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi, also in reference to a krach. And he says as follows. Krach, a walled city, sheyoshav, ulesof hukav, Nodon Kikfar. He says, okay, let's say you have a walled city which exists now, okay? But originally it was simply Yoshav. In other words, people came and they sit and they dwelt over there, but without doing what? Without building
a wall
around. All right. Then the time came and they decided to put up a wall over there, okay? Lefsov Hukav. So the question is, do we consider it as a krach for the purposes of the reading of Megillah or not? And the answer is no. It's nidon kichvar. You rule that it is to be considered like a kfar. In other words, the reading of Megillah will be when? It's going to be on the 14th of Adar, not on the 15th. My Tama, Gemara wants to know, what's the reason? Dichsiv? Well, we got a pasuk. What is the pasuk? The pasuk says, "The ish ki yimkar beis moshav ir chomo." Okay, here we are dealing you know, with a section that we read just the other week. You know, we started Parsha Bamidbar this past Shabbos, but the previous week we read Bahar B'chul Kosai. And in Bahar, we deal with all kinds of things as to the Jubilee year, if you remember, okay? And it affects real estate transactions and so on. One of the rulings that we have in regards to the Yovel, to the Jubilee year, is that if it is like a soda, like a field, okay, then in that particular case, even though it is a city, but it is to be considered as if it were a field, and therefore what? Therefore it means that when the Yovel comes, the house that you bought has to go back to the original owner, okay? Of course, I'm only giving the general idea. There could be, you know, exceptions. There are exceptions, all right? But this is the basic idea, okay? So, in other words, if the city did not have a wall around it, then in Yovel, the property is supposed to revert. And this is what the pasuk says over here. The ish, for man, ki yimko beis moshav, he sells a house for dwelling in an ir chomo, in a city with a wall. Now notice the order of the words, because this is what, you know, Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi is saying. He says, that shows you what, shehukaf, first of all, when was the wall put up? It was put up, right, when? After first it was what? Beis Moshe, first after people were building over there, right? So, therefore, we have to say shehukaf v'lefsof yoshav, v'lo sheyoshav v'lefsof hukaf. All right. Did I skip something for a change? No. Okay. So, anyway, the opinion that we get over here is a later wall is not going to count. That doesn't make it into a later city. What it has to be? It has to be that the wall was put up to begin with, right? When the city was created, immediately they should have built a wall around it, and then any house that was in it would follow the rule for a walled city as compared to the rule for an unwalled city. Okay? All right. So this is what he's saying over here. The young Rabbi Shimon ben Levi, and now Rabbi Shimon ben Levi comes along and he says, you know what? I have a different definition of the word krach. You know what a walled city or a metropolitan city should be? It says she'ein bo asor batlonin nidon kichfar. If it doesn't have 10 batlonin in it, then in that case it's to be considered like a village. Okay, so now we have to define what is the word batlon. Of course, today, if we would use the Yiddish word a batlon, so it means a person, you know, he's wasting his time, he doesn't have an occupation or something like that, you know. He's a poplin, he may just, may read, he may study something or other, but at any rate, he's not living a practical life. That's a poplin. Okay. Here, however, we have to take the definition, the word poplin, in the sense as what? He is botel bimlocha. He doesn't have a work to do, but because of the fact that he is free, so in that particular case, it means that he can come and attend minyan every day, okay? It means that he can go to shiurim every day and things like that. And so therefore, it's not a city if they don't have at least a steady minyan of people who are free, who are ready to come on a regular basis. Okay, that's the city. Yeah, retirees, whatever it may be. Right, right. Yeah, so this is about London. Okay, so that's
what it is.
Right. Well, I saw another interpretation about London, which says the 10 about London, these are actually like the Gaboyim, the Machazen, and so on and so forth, you know. So the people, you know, who they have the time in order to devote to working for communal affairs, and therefore they don't have, you know, necessarily employment of their own or something like that. Well,
it's a badge of honor, though.
Yeah, it is. All right. In this particular case, we say it can't exist without their help. Look,
about 10 men, you'd not consider
right,
a city.
Right. You know, I mean, David, I'll answer your question in a moment, okay? Yeah. We know that there are shuls, for example, that they struggle to keep a minyan. What do? They actually will pay people to come and to be members, in the, you know, to come to a minyan so that they could maintain it. So they're also called, you know, like Asura Batlodim, see,
right.
Okay? Yeah. Rabbi Rosenzweig told me about a large congregation of both in Montreal, where we'd certainly expect, I know that there are shuls with tremendous minyanim and so on. This was a shul with a huge membership. And he came and he said that they had a hire Russian Jews who had settled in Montreal, pay them in order to come to make a minyan in this particular place.
See that
Pardon me?
I still see the big memberships and all.
Yeah, yeah. Unfortunately, it happens. There's no question about that. Right. So, therefore, we say, okay, you want to be a big city, then you have to be able to maintain the minyan, even if you have to do what? You have to have Asura Batlodim who are there in order to carry on so that you can have a minyan for whatever activities are necessary. Okay. And if there isn't, then in that case, the city is considered like a kfar. It's like an open village. In other words, the reading of Megillah will be on the 14th and not the 15th. Yeah, David.
Well, at the time that this was written,
yeah.
About the issue of the Batlodim.
Right.
Were the Levium still an institution? Were they still in existence?
Yeah, the Levium was still there. Well, I have to tell you, originally from the Torah point of view, it's written that the Levi has no piece of real estate in Eretz Israel, right? That they don't have chelik v'nachlo b'Israel. Why? Because Hashem v'nachlosam. Rebbeinu Shel Olam is their heritage. Nevertheless, we do find that the Torah then decrees that there should be cities where the Levites are, or Malavim, okay? And there's supposed to be 48 such cities, and some of them would also serve, at least on a temporary basis, as a near Miklot, if you remember. Besides, you know, the six that were officially established, but it's possible also to find at least temporary refuge in the cities of the Levim. Okay. So they did have something. But of course, if you remember, you know, how would the Levim, what kind of parnosa did they have? So the answer is, you have to give maestros to them, right? You have to give the maaser rishon goes to the Levi, according to the Torah. Later on, because the Levium were not anxious to leave Babylonia, right, and come back to Eretz Yisrael, so what do we find? We find that they were punished. They received the knas in that from this point on, the maaser is supposed to go to a kohen instead of to a Levi. Okay. But I would say that by this time too, by the time they came back from, Golis, from Babylonian Golis, that the Levium also owned property and et cetera, and so the prohibition existed in the early days, but it didn't exist by the time of the second base of English. Right. That's what I would say. Yeah.
The Levium did not live in one central place together.
No, I said, according, the Torah set aside cities for Levium.
So they separated,
But obviously, there were Levium who were living outside of those cities, because after all, they served a function in Levium. They were there in order to assist in the teaching of Torah to the people and things like that, okay?
So in Babylonia, were they living as a coordinated group?
No. No, in Babylonia, they had Jewish settlements, the Kahanim, the Levium, but it was a mixture already at that time. And presumably, when they came back to Eretz Israel, you have exactly the same thing. How do we know? We learned, in the Gemara, in Tainis, we learned about the institution called Ma'amodos. In fact, we had reference to it very recently. What was the Ma'amod? The Ma'amod was that they divided Eretz Israel into 24 areas, okay? Call them 24 provinces, whatever you want to call them, okay? 24 counties, Okay? Something like that. 24 areas. And each area had its turn in being represented at the time of the Avodah and the Beis HaMikdash. So they had Kohanim for that area, they had Levim from that area, and they had Yisraelim, who also would come as representatives of the general population of that area, and they had to be present in the Beis HaMikdash at the time when the sacrifices were offered. And we learned in Gemara Titus that they had to fast, they had special readings of the Torah when they got together, and so on and so forth. Okay, so from this we can already see what? That everywhere you had Kahanim, you had Levim, you had Yisrael, all mixed in the general area. You no longer had anything specifically set aside just for Levim and for nobody else. But according to the law of the Torah, and undoubtedly for there were several centuries after the law, you know, after they settled in Eretz Yisrael, that this did exist. But eventually, you know, people moved to different areas and so on, and you had a mixture. Yes?
Clarify something for me.
Yeah.
Having a discussion about World Series.
Right.
Is the definition about reading the Megillah,
right,
about a walled city that was in the time of Joshua or in the time of Ahasuerus, right?
Right.
All right?
But
this whole discussion is taking place after that period, right?
Yes.
So what? So the discussion is really doesn't make any sense.
You want to know, is it relevant today?
It's not relevant. I mean, it's not relevant.
So I'm telling you, it's relevant in one city today. That's the city of Yerushalayim.
Yeah, that's the only place.
Okay. Even though there are other places that were mentioned, you know, that they were walled, but nevertheless, for practical purposes today, it's Yerushalayim where this applies.
Yeah.
Okay. If Shushan were in existence today, it would also apply.
If you built the city today, for instance, in Israel,
and built a wall around it,
it still would not be.
No, definitely not, because it wasn't there at the time of Yerushalayim. Period. Okay. But
it only refers to the state of the area of Israel.
Theoretically, it could refer to others. But since we don't know that any of them were in existence at the time. Right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I pointed out that, for example, I don't know when they put a wall around Rome. Okay? Not sure of that. Or around maybe the Acropolis in Athens or something like that. But the discussion doesn't even enter over there. I know from my own experience that, for example, there was at one time an area in Paris, I mentioned it, that was walled in, okay? Today you won't find a wall, but originally there was a wall over there. So, but when was Paris first created? I mean, that didn't begin to, you know, to be a city until centuries after Yerushalayim.
So the
right,
whole discussion about the wall, though, is in imitation.
That is correct. Right. If the Megillah had not insisted, you know, that if it hadn't used the word Phrozim, which means people living in open areas, the discussion maybe wouldn't have developed. But nevertheless, the Megillah does use the expression that says, okay, now Yehudim have Phrozim. Therefore, those Jews who live in open areas, right? So, you know, they celebrate this Yom Arbo Asor L'Chodesh Ador, okay? They celebrate the 14 days. So because it's mentioned, so therefore, following the example of Shushan, where there was 2 days of fighting, and not one day, and therefore they had a rest on the following day, on the 15th, so that this is what gives rise to the whole business over here. Okay. All right. So let's accept it. I mean, we're trying to work this out, but for practical reasons, you know, it's really today it's Yerushalayim that is affected by this. Okay. But nevertheless, in the study of the Gemara, we don't always come immediately to the conclusion. We want to see what is the thought process that takes place, the arguments back and forth, how do they derive a teaching and so on, you see. That's important because, you know, if we had only conclusions for this, you don't need a Gemara. For that, you can go to the word krach, and we see that in the final analysis, it has to be that even, you know, if it contains a wall, but the question is whether that wall makes it truly a walled city or it still is to be considered like an open city. And then we got into the discussion of what are asara batlanim, right? Because the Kondrab Shuma and Levi says that a city which does not have asara batlanim is like a village. So the Gemara says, "Maika Mashmala." Okay, what is he trying to teach us? It says, "Tanina, we have learned in the Gemara, in the Baraisa, which says, Ezuhi ir gedola, how can we consider a city a big city?" Notice he's not using the word krach over here. But in general, what is the definition of a big city? So he says, "Kol sheyesh bo asara batlanim," right? It's a city where you have to have at least 10 batlanim over there who are available for public service, right, to come to daven and to take care of other needs as well. Tochas makan, but if you have less than 10 batlanim, harezek kfar, then in that case, that's not a big city, that's a village. Okay. Krach, it's the rechlei. I forgot the miklei lei, the alba. Okay, so he says, well, after all, we need the definition of krach in order to know, even though, let's say, it may be a big city where people come in to visit, like, for example, in New York, you have tourists coming in, right? Or, let's say, in Springfield tonight, we had several young men who came from Yeshiva University, so they fell in over there. Are we to say that this comes into the category of creating a city? So the answer is no. When we talk about asara batlanim, we mean that they have to be part of the regular population and not simply people coming in from the outside for a temporary
Right.
And again another statement to attributed to him, krach shechora. Let's take the case of a city which first it was built with a wall, right? And then the wall was destroyed, chorav, right? You know, it's related to the word korban, right?
Korban.
Yep. Okay. Vilifsov Yoshav. And then afterwards, people came and they resettled in this particular area. So, what shall you consider it? So he says, don't you krach. In that case, since it had a wall to begin with, so it is to be judged as if it is a walled city. So they say, my chorav, what do you mean, destroyed? Ilema chavuchamaisa, are we talking about if the walls were destroyed? So he says, yoshav in, lo yoshav lo. If people are living there, okay. If people don't live over there, no. The hotanyo. And then we learn Rabbi Eliezer by Yosef Yomer, he says, Asher lo chomo. Now we have an interesting pasuk again, coming back to Asher Bahar. A city is Asher lo chomo. Now take a look at the spelling of lo. How is it spelled? Lamed vav aleph. Now, lamed vav aleph would indicate what? No, which doesn't have. But from the context of the pasuk, we have to understand it, that it does have a wall. So how do you figure that out? The answer is, we read it, you know, we have what we call kri and ksiv, right? In other words, one way to read it, another way in which it's written in the Torah, and the kri is as if it were written lamed vav. You understand? City to which there is a wall. Understand? So he says, okay, why the vav and why the aleph? Right? One indicating it has, the other one, it indicates what? It doesn't have. Correct? So he says, afalpi, even though she'ein lo achshav, right? Even though now it doesn't have a wall, but it did have a wall prior to that, right? One it has, lo, and the other one it doesn't have, right? So, in that particular case, what? Then we have to assume that it is a walled city. You understand? Elo, my chorav. So, give me a translation of the word chorav, that it was destroyed. Not the walls, that's not the important thing, but rather she'chorav me'asar batlonim. It was destroyed because of the fact that you can't get a minyan together over there in the town. That's chorav. That's chorav. Okay. So then, in that case, what do we say? Nidon kechfar, right? It has to be judged as if we're only a village if we can't get a minyan together over there. I don't have to tell you that there are plenty of places in America today with their cities, right? Plenty of thousands of people living over there, and yet you can't get a minyan for whatever it may be, for any purpose. Okay. Okay. Now we'll learn a little bit longer. Start the next page. All right. Remember Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi? And again, yeah, let's give out the next page over there. Phil, you're in charge of the new page. Pass them out. Yeah. Okay. Do we have new pages? Yeah. Okay. All right. Another statement attributed to Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi. Right? He says, Lord, the Ono, the Geach HaRashim, Mukafos Chomo Mimos Yoshua bin Nun. Habo. Okay. He says, there are certain places which happen to be mentioned in the Bible, all right, including Lod. Actually, Lod is the city of, you know, where Ben Gurion Airport today is located. Oh, it's the wrong word. It should begin with the word Lod on top. You don't have Lod on top.
The other one was page 6, this is page 8.
Yeah. Okay, we need Dalet Amud Alef. Let me see, maybe I have it in there. My apologies.
Here.
Want me to look? Yeah. Does it say Dalet Amud Alef on it? You see a big Dalet in the left-hand corner? Let me see. Yeah, this is the one. My apologies. Okay. Phil? You're in the distribution.
Here. This is all. That's the last one.
Yeah. Okay.
No, it's
that's my problem.
That's some mercy.
Okay. So, as I said, we find mention of towns. Lod, we still know where Lod is. Ono, I think that there is a place called Ono in modern Israel also today. All right, Geach HaRashim, I'm not familiar whether there's any such place today in Israel. Okay, but at any rate, they are cities which are mentioned as belonging to the tribe of Binyamin. Now, Binyamin, if you're familiar, is actually north of Yerushalayim, because Yerushalayim itself was a city, you know, like D.C., which contains elements that were originally Maryland and originally Virginia, right? And they made a capital district, okay? So Yerushalayim, too, likewise, was partly territory taken from Yehuda and partly territory taken from Binyamin. Yehuda would be to the south, and Binyamin would be to the north. So these were places that were in Binyamin. This is why I don't think that the Lod over here is necessarily the same Lod which where the airport is, because that's closer to what we say that would be the area of Dan. Gush Dan, okay? Yeah, near Tel Aviv, right. That was considered the territory where the Shevet Dan was running around, and because this is where Shimshon would run around, okay? It's where we go chasing Philistine girls and so on, okay? So this is Dan, okay. So maybe there was another town by the name of Lod. But at any rate, these were in the territory of Binyamin, and they were walled cities at the time of Yehoshua ben Nun, right? So the Gemara asked the question, because this is really part of the question of Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi. He says, "V'hana Yehoshua ben Anhu?" Wait a minute, he says. You mean to tell me that Joshua built them? No, they were built after Joshua. The Ho El Pa'el ben Anhu. Why? We have somebody by the name of El Pa'el who came and he built these places. And, you know, and that would be at a later period. Dirsiv, and we have a Pasuk. The Pasuk is in Divrei Hayomim, the Book of Chronicles, where it says, "V'nei El Pa'al, Ever, Misham, Shomer," right? These are his children, right? And then it says, "Hu bono es Ono, v'es Lod, v'noseho." He is the one who built Ono and Lod and, you know, the surrounding cities, okay? So, and if I go according to your opinion, then there's an even later person who built these cities. In other words, we have to assume that they were settled, they were destroyed, they were settled, they were destroyed. You understand what I'm saying? So who was it? It would be Asa ben Anhu. Asa was a later king of Yehuda, and he built it. Dirsiv, and again we have in Divrei Hayomim a statement which says, "Vayiven Asa es Areha Pzuras Asher Yehuda," that Asa built the fortified cities which belongs in Judah. So Omer Rabbi Elazar, said, "Hani Mekofes Chaimim Moshe Yehoshua Binu." He gives the explanation. He said, "All right, they were taka built with walls when in the days of Joshua ben Nun." Okay, taba. Then Chorav Bimei Pelegesh Megiva. Then they were destroyed when there was a war which the Israeli tribes, the Israel tribes, waged against the tribe of Binyamin. A very, very sad story that we find towards the end of the Book of Judges, the end of the Book of Shoftim, where we read that some of the people in Shevet Binyamin mistreated a woman, and the people of the other tribes were so horrified at what had taken place that they waged war against Shevet Binyamin, and then eventually they had to come to terms, you know, with each other. So, in other words, we have to assume that what happened, that during the time of the Milchemes, you know, the Pelegesh Megivot, at that particular time, that the cities of Binyamin there were destroyed. The Osa El Pal, so then at a later time along came El Pal, Binod, and he built these cities up again. Hodor Inpal, and then the cities fell again. So Osa, and then Osa came along, Shapinstum, and what did he do? He fixed up the cities. Today in Hebrew, they use the word Shiputzim in the sense that, you know, you make all kinds of repairs in the house, okay? And so Dikaname, and all right, look very closely at the Pasuk, Dirsiv, because it's written by Yomer Yehuda, that he said to Yehuda, because we're talking about Asa, "Nivne Esorim Ha'ele," let us rebuild, let us build literally, but I'm translating it as rebuild these cities, "Niklal de Orem Avum Eikor," which shows that the cities were there to begin with, but now they needed rebuilding, "Shema Mino," and therefore this proves the fact, what? That they were places that were built in the days of Yehoshua ben Nun. But I don't have to tell you that none of these are in existence in modern Israel, and even the Lod and the Ono, that even though the names exist, but it doesn't mean that they are the same places that existed back in those days. Okay, with this we shall call it a night.
The
night is already the 13th of June in the year 2001. It happens to be Chof Gimel in the month of Tammuz of Chof Shin Samach Aleph, and we are ready to begin the shiur for tonight. Okay. We have had in the past page or so, the past daf, a series of statements by Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi, okay, who was a great authority.
Yehoshua ben Levi.
Where you see the abbreviation Vav Aleph Resh Yud Beis Lamed. You see that? I'll tell you where it is. Okay. 3, 6, 9. Okay, it's on the 12th line from the top.
Okay.
Got it.
Sure. Yeah. Of course, you have to get used to abbreviations. Like, for example, what is Shin Mem over there? The answer is Shmavino, which means, see, now we've taught you something. We've learned something, okay? And then you see Vav, Aleph, Resh, Yud, Beis, Lamed, right? And you can see this abbreviation. So how do you know how to read it? The answer is it's V'Omar Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi, right? Which means that Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi said also this. Now, we've had a series of statements made by Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi. Primarily, they dealt with the problem of cities which are walled as compared to cities which are not walled. And we haven't finished this particular inyan, as we would say, as yet. But now we're getting in again. We continue with the study of the various dinim, the halachas, concerning the reading of the Megillah. Okay. So now we are ready on line 12. I'll just wait one moment for Bob to find his place. We now come to a statement of Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi, and in this connection, I want to also make use of the Rashi of Tosfos as well. Okay? Yeah, it's recording. Okay, good evening, good evening. Okay, I'll give you a moment.
A few more okays.
Okay, it says, V'yomer Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi. Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi also said the following. He said, No shimcha yovos b'mikra Megillah, that the women are also required to hear the reading of the Megillah.
Right.
Now, of course, I added the word to hear, but in reality, we'll see that that's already a question of, it's a debatable point, okay? The debatable is not whether they should hear the Megillah, but whether they're also entitled to read the Megillah. This is a question. That's what I meant, okay? But definitely women are involved in the celebration
reading,
of Purim
reading.
And the reading of the Megillah. Why? She'afein hu yibayis ha'anez. Because they too were involved in that miracle. All right, so now I want to turn to Rashi, first of all, and then we'll turn to Tosfos, okay? All right, Rashi, okay. Yeah, Afhein, okay. It's several lines down. You see where it says the Kamon Lamed Beis?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. Go down one, two, on the third line towards the end, after that, okay? Okay, they too were involved in
that
miracle. Okay, so we'll see how Rashi understands it. By the way, for those of you who aren't expert in reading Rashi, the script, so
listen
carefully, but look at it with your eyes and follow it. Okay, because the script is not exactly the same as you can see, you know, in the middle column over there. Okay, all right.
Where are you?
Yeah, Sha'af hein hui bosanes. It says, Sha'af al noshim gozar homon lahashmid la rugal abed, but now that's okay, taf in noshim. Okay. Rashi explains what was the involvement of the women. He says, because the miracle was that women too were subject to the decree to destroy everybody. Lahashmid la rugal abed, right, to destroy, to murder, to cause the perish. Minarvia Tzokin, you know, young and old, Tafinoshim, children, women, and so on. This is what Amin wanted, destroy them all. So since the women were delivered by the miracle of Purim, so that therefore they too have an obligation in the reading of the Megillah. Okay. Now, this is Rashi. Very simple. Okay. Now we go to the Tosfos. That's on the opposite plane, side of the page, okay? Where it says, Doshim Chayovos B'mikra Megillah. You see that?
Yeah.
Okay. So we'll start over here, first of all, explaining what Tosfos has to say. We'll see that Tosfos finds, you know, that there are, at times, different contradictory statements that we come across. At any rate, he starts by saying, you know, women are also required, in the, you know, to participate in the reading of the Megillah. He says, Mekad Mashma, from this we learn, listen to what Tosfos says, Sha'anoshim Motziyos Sacherim Deifel Nesan, that women too can enable others to fulfill the agreement, to fulfill the mitzvah of listening to the reading of the Megillah. Midaloka Omar, since he didn't say the Shmoa Mikra Megillah, that women are required to hear the reading of the Megillah. Okay? So, as we see, Tosfos already introduces a very a radical idea, so to speak, which, of course, I don't have to tell you, is a controversy that exists to this very day. Namely, are women permitted to read the Megillah in public? That's right. I'm not talking about in private, in public, right? And secondly, whether by their reading do they enable others to fulfill the obligation to hear the reading of the Megillah. This is what Tosfos is suggesting at this particular point. And he brings another proof of this from another statement, where it says, V'hochi nami, and this too we learn, Mashma, he says, V'arochin. Arochin is the name of one of the tractates in the Talmud, and it's on the second page, Daf Beis over there. The Ka'omar, where the Gemara there says, Hakol Kishel Mikros HaMegillah. Everybody is kosher to read the Megillah. Umasik, and he comes to a conclusion, Hakol Kisherim, when it says Hakol, everybody, the question of the Gemara always asks, because we have other Gemaras that also begin with the word Hakol, this and that. For example, Gemara Cholin, which deals, first of all, in the first chapter, with who is permitted to shecht, to be a shechet, okay? Mm-hmm. And it begins also with the same expression, Akol shochtin, right? V'shchitoson kishera, it says. Everybody can shecht, yeah. And their shchita is kosher. But then they say, you know, yeah, all right, so let's bring it down. Who is it, all right? Who are you adding? And this and that, and so they go on. So we have others, as I say, you know, there are other places in Gemara too that whenever it starts with Hakol, everybody does this, then after that they want to know, yeah, okay.
So what's the final decision in something like that?
In something like that, well, they go into the question of, for example, with somebody who is a mumar, in other words, he's not living a Jewish life, or he converted to a Goyish religion, is he, for example, permitted to do it?
Yeah,
obviously, we would not accept
it. How is it with regard
to
women, though?
Okay. With women, we say that if there's a man standing over there and he saw that everything is perfectly kosher, that, you know, she shechted and she did the right thing and she followed all the laws and so on, so, but then, as we say, b'di'evet means if it's been done, it's been done and it's kosher. But chachila, to begin with, a woman does not do it. I mean, they're afraid. Look. There's many a man who can't shecht.
Yeah.
Take my word for it.
I mean,
you take a knife in your
right.
hand, and you're face to face with an animal, you're face to face with a fowl, or something like that. It's not the easiest profession in the world. Take my word for it.
So now they're discussing the using hakol, but they're talking about the reading of the Megillah.
Right, correct. Right. Exactly.
We haven't come up with an answer yet. So
no, we didn't come up with an answer yet. He's quoting so far, okay?
Slept up in the air.
Okay. So lasuye mai. So what? Who are we adding to this? So he says, "Mishane lasuye moshe." Hakol means, in this particular case, we are adding the fact that women too can read the Megillah. Mashma, if that's the case, he says, then the implication is lahotzi afilu anoshim, right? The implication is then that a woman can enable even men to fulfill the mitzvah of listening to, you know, to the reading of the Megillah. And now he says, for kosher, however, this is difficult. Okay. In other words, first they present argument A, and then they're going to present a counter argument.
Let me
okay.
ask you a question.
Yes.
It says reading a Megillah.
Right.
Not hearing the Megillah.
Correct.
So the obligation really for everyone is to read the Megillah and not to hear it, just to hear it.
Okay.
The question whether the person who is not obligated to do enables another who is obligated.
This is a big problem that always comes in as far as Kavona is concerned. We had this problem in the blowing of the shofar, if you remember.
Yeah, exactly.
In the blowing of the shofar,
everybody
learned that Rosh Hashanah,
yeah.
Right. I mean, theoretically, you know, people may be a cotton, a woman or something like that, but in reality, can either of them be motzi
for the
people,
other
everybody?
Yeah.
And we learned that they cannot. But, of course, the only one who can do it has to be somebody who is capable, that he, number one, is obligated in the mitzvah, and secondly, also that he has the kavana, that he wants to enable everybody else in order to fulfill the obligation,
so
I guess.
Can he be that way he can't be a minor then, right?
Right.
He never could be a minor, even if he's capable?
Even if he's capable,
and
frankly, he should not. Right.
But in case there wasn't anyone available?
Oh, now you're talking a different problem.
Yeah.
Right.
But
if there's nobody else who's available, then in this particular case, we could rely upon the more lenient opinion or something like that.
When it comes to the same thing, okay, I'm jumping the gun here, but when it comes to a woman reading the Megillah for the benefit of other people, if there are men available who are able to read the Megillah, would it then not be kosher for her to read?
That is correct. In other words, a man then is
take
the one who he should take presents.
Yeah,
why?
Definitely. Why? Because he is, you know, it's what Greg referred to. Greg was quoting a Gemara which says, you know, Godol HaMitzuva V'Oisa. Okay? The person who is commanded in order to perform a mitzvah, you know, so he is, his place is greater or something like that. He takes priority. Understand? Don't understand.
I don't understand.
You have
I mean,
a scale of values.
I'm not being a woman's liver, but I'm just saying.
I understand.
I don't understand why it's more kosher for a man to read than a man.
Because men have a primary obligation. Why? I'll come back.
Hold it.
I'll come back to this in 1 second. Let's continue with the first verse, and then we'll see. Okay. After that, we can okay.
I don't want to get into it, but
this is why it's important, you know, that when we do this, not just the text, but it's also good to study the commentaries on the text, particularly Russian texts. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So here goes. All right. So far we've given you the. You know, the affirmative, right? Okay. And as we say, now comes along Tosfos and says, he says, for kosher. He says, it's difficult for me. The Hobbit Tosefta, because in the Tosefta, remember, the Tosefta is Mishnayos, it's a whole collection of Mishnayos, quoted again and again in the Gemara, but not officially part of the Mishnah. So that Tosefta means, you know, that's something which is additional. Good evening, Saul. How are you?
Is it on the same level as Raisa?
Huh?
Is Tosefta on the same level?
Yeah, except that the Raisas were never made into a permanent collection. They were always quoted, but you never had really a collection of the Raisas. Some odd times, I mean, there was
but
a certain Tosefta, man that I knew.
But Tosefta was a collection.
Rabbi Higger, who this was his job, he wanted to get collections of the Raisas. Okay, but
the Tosefta was collected as a formal.
Tosefta definitely was formally
formal,
right, because all you have to do is to take a look in the back of any Gemara which has not yours because you don't have it, but you know in the back where they have what my son calls the boys at the back.
The boys at the back. give me the boys at the back.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. You have the Raj. You have Pesachim Tosfos. You have. You know, a lot of others and other commentaries, etc., from Stana, you name it, and so on, Kedusha, Agodas of Arshaw, etc., okay? So very often they also print the Tosefta as well. This one does not have it, I
But
see.
Why are all these, aren't those commentaries studied?
Okay. You ask a very good question. The answer is yes, you know, when they're studied. to study if a person has 8-10 hours a day in order to study.
Okay.
Yeah. Sit down in the Gemara, they go through everything in the front and in the back in order to try to understand. Okay? But, you know, when you only have an hour or two or something like that, you know, to do, then usually you don't go into all of it. Okay? But, same
but
time,
it is studied.
It's important to know, right? And this is why I felt it was important for us to study the Rashi and the Tosfos at this particular point. Okay? All right. So, at any rate, it says, Robert Tosefta, here in the Tosefta, he says, Neba Hedya, we have learned explicitly, the Tumtum Ein Motzi, Lo Es Minoi, Velo Es Sheino Minoi. It's a funny Tosefta that they're quoting over here, okay?
Tumtum.
Okay. Tumtum is somebody who you don't know what is the gender of that person because they have no distinguishing. They have no distinguishing sexual characteristics, okay? So that's a Tumtum. Okay. Today in Hebrew, if you want to say somebody is Metumtum, that's the adjective, so Metumtum means that that person is you're crazy, you're sugar,
don't know
some
what
sugar.
Coming
right,
up
right, okay, right.
So that's why Tumult
comes back. Maybe, except I'll tell you it's not for that. Because the word Tumult, to begin with, actually, it's really a Latin word, and it's gone into European languages. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah. Tumultus or
Tumultus.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Probably comes from Tumma,
right? Okay. Yeah.
So it says that a Tumtum cannot enable either another Tumtum or anybody who is not a Tumtum to fulfill an obligation.
Since we don't know any Tumtums, we don't care about it.
But an androgynous, you know what an androgynous is? That's somebody who has both male and female.
ATDC.
Androgynous. Yeah. Motzi is. He says, if there are other people who are androgynouses, okay, then in that particular case, he would enable them to fulfill their obligation, but not people who are not. He cannot enable a person who is a normal person, male, female, makes no difference, you know.
Does he get reasons why? Why not?
Yeah, because you
why
you
not?
Don't know what to use. Okay, still don't know. Okay. So Uvashita says Tosfos, the law of Difa Isha be androgynous. Right? You have to assume that a woman is certainly superior to an androgynous. Okay. Vachem Pascha Alochus Oilois, right.
See, that showed you the male chauvinistic
character. So, and now he quotes one of the early codes of Jewish law that Hey Gimel means the Halochus Gedolos. Okay? It says, and likewise, the Psak, in other words, you know, the decision of the Halochus Gedolos was the Isho Motsio Mino, that a woman can enable other women to fulfill their obligation, avolo anoshim, but not men. Okay. Now, this already is more or less accepted as the current thing. I mean, this is why, but although I have to tell you, I mean, Rabbi Tzvi was very much opposed to the whole business of the women's minyan. He was. Because he didn't feel that, from the point of view of halacha, it was really justified. Okay.
But this contradicts Rabbi Tzvi, because
this
seems to be right.
Well, this is only Tosfos.
Right. Obviously, you're going to have opinions since the time of Tosfos too, where they argue this point back and forth. Okay, but the justification for it we find over here. That's what I'm pointing out. Right, in Tosfos.
Is it the Talmud?
No,
I mean.
You mean the text of the Gemara?
Yeah.
Well, the text that he quoted from the first page of Arafin would certainly seem to prove that. Okay.
Yeah,
not mentioned over here. All it says over here is that they are obligated for the Mikra Megillah, for the reading of the Megillah. But how you interpret it, whether it is to listen or to actually do the actual reading, this is not determined. But there, it would seem to indicate that it is, that a woman can read the Megillah. And she can also enable other people to fulfill the right. Okay, so here Tosfos says that, you know, they quote Tosefta, which proves that a woman can enable other women to fulfill the obligation, but not men. Okay? Okay. Now he says, V'yesh lomar. And now, let us try to solve this problem, okay? The salkodate, if you think the lo yoyil kriyoson, that the reading has no value whatever, afila lo tzi hanoshim, even to enable women to fulfill their obligation, kamashmalon, therefore we learn, the chayovim, that they are obligated to, right? The akol chayovim bishmiya, that everybody is okay. That everybody is required to hear the reading of the Megillah. Okay?
They're weaseling out of it.
Right. Brought in Noshim, Tanim, in other words, slaves, and women, and minors, and so on and so forth. Okay, that they are. All right. You asked me a different question. Okay. You asked the question before. I hadn't forgotten your question. Okay. What is the justification for it? Justification for this problem is actually based upon something that we have in Gemara Kedushin, and it's also repeated in several other places as well. We had it, for example, in Gemara Brachos also, where they quote it. Okay. And that is as follows. We have a halacha which states that Noshim Keturos the Nitzvahs Aseh Shas Ban Groma, that women are excused from those mitzvahs which are dependent upon time for their fulfillment.
We
of course,
that's
me. Yeah, you had it in prophets. As I say, originally it was in Kedushin and prophets and so on. Right. And it's repeated several other places as well. Okay? So, the reading of the Megillah and Purim in general is obviously, you know, it's a question of time that's involved too. There's a time element. Okay? So that, therefore, being the case, if we apply that particular halacha, then in that case we'd have to say that men are obligated and women are not obligated, which brings us back again to what Greg said before, that we mentioned that, you know, if a person has an obligation to do it, then he can enable others to fulfill the obligation. But if a person does not have an obligation, then he does not enable somebody else to fulfill. So this is the problem. Okay?
Mm-hmm. All right. I accept that.
Yeah. All right. Now, I want to do also the next Tosfos. Okay?
Sha'af
Hein Hoyevos Hades. Okay? Remember, Rashi said that, what does it mean that they too were included in that same miracle, the miracle of Purim? Namely, that Haman wanted to destroy everybody, kill everybody, men, women, children, and so on, so that therefore, since everybody was saved from it, right, including women, so therefore, you know, they're also involved, and therefore, you know, they are obligated to hear the reading of the Megillah. So, along comes Tosfos, and this quotes, first of all, the Rashbam. Anybody know who the Rashbam is? Shmuel ben Meir, correct, right. The Rashbam is the grandson of Rashi, right, one of the great authorities, okay? Rashi had daughters. Baruch Hashem, they were all married to Talmidei Chachamim, and he had Einiklef that he could be very, very proud of, okay? So, as a result, you know, these people also were continually quoted in Tosfos, because Tosfos grew up in the generation after Rashi. This is when we have the Tosfos, okay? So they quote the Rashban, they quote Rabbeinu Tam, who is another grandson.
He doesn't take he doesn't take God with Rashi's opinion, but it just adds to it.
They may add, or may they, or they may disagree with Rashi.
Yeah.
There is a place where it says one of the Rashban, he wrote a commentary to some of the Chumash. Okay, and it says in one place that I went over this with my Zayda. Rashi, okay? And Rashi said that, you know, after talking to you and considering what you have to say, maybe if I would rewrite it, I would think along the same lines. But I'm too old already to rewrite it.
And how old was he by then?
I don't remember the exact age. Right. I would say that Rashi was probably about 60 years old or so at that time.
Right.
Okay. As it is, Rashi did such tremendous work. when you consider all the books of the Bible that he commented on, when you consider the Gemaras that he commented on, you have to realize he had an encyclopedic mind. I mean, the Rambam is another one. Same life, you know, Maimonides also had an encyclopedic
mind. Everything.
So that, you know, he really spent a lifetime in this. At the same time, Rashi had to make a living, you know, too. He didn't simply spend his time in the academy. He had a vineyard. He grew grapes and he sold wine.
Huh?
And that's why somebody has a brand called Rashi Brand Wine.
Rashi Brand. Yeah.
Yes, correct. That part of France where he lived, it's the area which includes the province. No, not southern France at all. Southern France was a different area. He lived actually in Champagne.
Champagne,
of course, in English we call the Champagne, you know. But Champagne was the name of the province in which he lived. Okay.
Where is that?
It's eastern France, sort of northeastern France, okay? You have Champagne, you have Bourgogne, which in English is called Burgundy. Right? And you know, why do they call these wines Champagne, Burgundy? Because the grapes in each area are quite different. And therefore, there's a very distinctive flavor to the wines that are made in those areas.
Yeah.
That area is also close to the province of Alsace and Lorraine. Alsace and Lorraine. So that, you know, all that area, as I say, in those days it was vine producing. And of course, I don't have to tell you that it was
they
the center of a great Jewish scholarship.
Wouldn't they have traveled west out of the German area?
Well, there was travel going on all the time, sure.
I mean,
because the Rhineland communities were very close to the French communities.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Particularly
through
Crusades, right?
Russia. Yes, he did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he lived in the time of the Crusades, absolutely.
He lived in the time of the Crusades.
Yeah, approximately 1100, correct. Yeah. Give or take a few centuries. Okay, no, it was about 1100, is correct.
Rashi didn't have a school.
He had a school in the sense that people came to learn Torah with him.
Yeah.
Right.
But he was not. Like some of the others had their disciples, their followers, their school.
Well, he certainly did. Oh, no, no. People came to learn with him. There's no question about that. Certainly they did.
Because he was a sage.
Because what?
He was a sage. They knew.
Yeah, naturally. Naturally. Of course, people wanted to learn Torah from him. There's no question. This is true of any great rabbi, that people want to learn Torah from him. Yes. We have tshuvas that he wrote, yeah, definitely. Yeah, there are tshuvas.
Rashi, right.
Wrote
tshuvas?
Yeah, he wrote tshuvas.
About the same time as the Rambam?
No, Rambam is later.
Later?
Right. I don't know that the Rambam even knew the existence of Rashi, because he lived in Spain. So the only part of France which had contact with Spain was southern France. Cities like Perpignan, Toulouse, etc., etc., okay?
Mm-hmm.
Later on, there was a fusion, you know. In other words, after the time of the Rambam, his doctrines spread to northern France, and as a result, we find, you know, that, for example, in the city of Orléans, or in Sens, something like that, you know, that we find that, you know, you have people who were able to begin to combine both the Rambam and Rashi's commentaries, you know, the schools, of the thoughts of both of these schools, okay? And the greatest exponent of that, that is the original one, the one who is the greater, who is the Rosh, Rabbeinu Asher, okay? And then his son was Rabbi Yaakov Balatur.
Well, the Balatur,
right.
Yeah.
Like seven brothers, all rabbis.
But as I say, they also had to make a living too. The Rambam, you know how he made his living. He was a doctor, a physician.
I thought he was a doctor.
To the Sultan of Egypt, of course. The Saladin, you know, the famous Saladin.
He was a great Saladin. too bad they burnt a lot of his books.
So Haredi in Israel can work a little bit, right?
He was a great doctor. He had some reports that they don't know.
There are many Haredim who work. Don't believe that every Haredi sits and waits to collect money. That's not true. They've been maligned by the left-wingers who don't know what life is like among the Haredim and so on. Believe me, there's a very beautiful family life among many Haredim, and the people do try to work wherever they can in order to earn money. They don't simply sit in the kollel all the time. Sure, you have people who sit in kollel. I agree with that. But by the same token, not everybody who's a Haredi simply sits in order to collect a welfare check. Okay? Not so. Okay. All right. Now, Perush HaRashba. All right, what we're doing tonight, we're concentrating on little Tosfos. Okay. Doesn't do any harm. It's good to learn Tosfos too. So, Sha'af Hein Hoya Boisan Neis. Okay, so Perush HaRashba. The Rashbam explained as follows. It says, Ikar HaNeis HaYal Yodon B'Purim. He says, you know, the major miracle that took place actually happened in Purim through the women. Adyadei Esther, right? Purim it was because of Esther. This is the reason why the miracle happened. The Chanukah, and what happened at Chanukah? The miracle was Adyadei Yehudis. Okay? You know who this Yehudis is. Judith and Holofernes and so on. You know, it's a story that you find in the Apocrypha, but of course, you know, there are oral traditions about Judith. How, you know, she got this Greek general.